Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And, of course, joining us on the line is the one and only Anne Burgess. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here with you.
Wow. So you've got quite the history in crime. And what got you into the field that you're in and this whole...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, because I started out never dreaming I'd get into this field. But when I got into academe, which was not my main interest, I was interested just being a nurse psychotherapist, but was recruited into academe, and while there met a sociologist who came to Boston College about the same time, Linda Holmstrom, who was looking for a new research project. And so when I talked with her, she came up with some very interesting ideas and knew at the time that the whole issue of rape was going to be a big issue for women. And so that's where we decided to join forces, so to speak, and I went about trying to find a hospital emergency room where I knew victims would be taken, and that led me to Boston City Hospital, and we made arrangements there, and that's how the whole project got started.
So the behavioral science unit at the FBI, how did you get involved with that?
Right. Well, that came because we had done the rape study and were starting to publish on it at the kind of the same time the women's movement was putting a lot of pressure on Congress to do something about law enforcement and dealing with victims, etc. So the group that does all the training for law enforcement at the time, probably still, is the FBI Academy, the Training Academy. So they were given the task of coming up with training for the agents and for law enforcement on rape victimology. Well, then the next point is they had to find someone to teach it, and they assigned it to the newest person coming, I guess, into the academy, which happened to be Roy Hazelwood. So Roy gets this assignment. He happens to be out in Los Angeles doing a Rhodes School on hostage negotiation, and afterwards is talking with some of the police officers and mentions this new assignment that he had. And when he kind of asks everybody who knows anybody that knows anything about this, one of the juvenile police officers was Rita Connect, who also had earlier been a registered nurse and who was keeping her skills up over at the local emergency room. She said she had just read this article, which happened to be the very first article that Linda and I had written, and it was in the American Journal of Nursing, which is our main journal, and it was just called The Rape Victim in the Emergency Room. So Rita said, I think this nurse is out on the East Coast. Why don't you give her a call? And Roy did and invited me down to teach on this, and that's really how it got started, because I then met the other agents, which included Bob Ressler and John Douglas, who had just begun their project on the criminal personality study on serial offenders.
So what was your actual role in the behavioral science unit?
Well, my role then became, as I listened to them talk, I said, well, you really need to professionalize it a bit. In fact, if you look at the third episode in the first series, that is a pretty accurate about how the agents came, talked with me when I was at Boston College, and I kind of impressed upon them how important it was to professionalize their methodology, so to speak. So they asked me to help with them, and that's really how it started. We came up with a 57-page questionnaire. They had to fill out, I think there were 488 variables, so we really developed quite a database. And so then my job was, after we got the assessment form, is to make sure the data get entered, and then I had, by that time, had received some money from National Institute of Justice and had a team, an analytic team, that could then crunch down the numbers and come up with the statistics, and then we wrote it up and published it as a book and also journal articles for law enforcement. So my role was really from the methodology part and making sure that we had a good database and interpreting the data. That was important, to use behavioral terms rather than just psychological terms. That was the one thing they didn't want to do. They wanted to make it more law enforcement, if you will. And as John Douglas said to me one time, he says, I don't know how I can go out and find somebody who's got an Oedipus complex, you know, which was a kind of a psychological term at that time. He says, I need behavior. I need to know, like, what age to look for, how tall they are, what they work at, what their relationships are, et cetera, et cetera. And that was really the beginning of profiling. So we really had two studies going on. We had the criminal personality, which was to look at 36 serial killers who had 112 victims and tell it, like, as we learned about it, since nobody was talking about sexual killers. And then the other piece was to do the profiling. How did they then take all of a case comes in, put all the crime scenes on the table, talk about them, and then come up with a profile? That was the second part of the project.
How do you feel the FBI was, and was there resistance within the FBI for what you guys were doing?
Well, there was resistance in terms of make sure that you do things that make us look good, so to speak, which I think everybody always wants. You know, you want to do something to make your employer look good. But it was also that they had a mandate, so to speak. It was William Webster was there at the time, and he said, we want you doing research. We're an academic training program, and academic training programs do research. He was very right. And I remember him saying to Bob Ressler, you can't, don't make this shoebox research. Make sure it's very, very reputable and can pass the peer test, so to speak. So they had a high bar that they wanted to do, which was excellent, because you certainly want research that's good. And so that they didn't resist it. Once I think the director came out in support of it, the only resistance would be on the profiling. Now, are you really sure that you're doing this profiling right? That we really are going to reduce the suspects, that shrink the suspect list, I think is the way they put it. That was the purpose of profiling, is to reduce the number of suspects and help law enforcement to really focus in on the ones that seem to have the most characteristics from the profile.
What kind of reaction did you get from your peers, like in academia and science?
Well, it wasn't a popular topic. It still isn't. So there was some resistance from that standpoint. Certainly in my field, nursing, it was this was kind of a new area of nurses doing this. There wasn't too much resistance. There was, I think one of the lucky things is they didn't give us a lot of attention because I don't think they were that interested. So we were able to pretty much do our counseling and interviewing, at least of the rape study at the hospital. And then, of course, down at the academy, they were getting so many cases in that they wanted some help, so it was a little bit different for them. They were trying to train some people so that they could answer these questions when law enforcement would say, gee, we have this case, we need to find out who's doing it, et cetera, et cetera.
So it's still not popular today, even with all the TV shows and stuff?
I think it's very popular today from the offender standpoint. There seems to be great fascination with crime, and I think it's for two reasons. One, just the fascination of what people do to each other. But then second of all, from a prevention standpoint, I know that when I talk about victims and the situations that happen to them, I know that people are kind of storing this in their own memory to say, gee, if I'm ever in a tight situation, I wonder if I could do this. Because I would always tell them the stories about the victims that survived and then the victims who got more injured because of something that they did in the commission of the offense that really set the offender off.
Have you ever really considered what it is that draws people to true crime? If you have an opinion on that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, my opinion would be, again, as you say, the fascination with it is to learn something. I would hope that's what it is. Now, it may not be. I guess that would be a research question, but it's, can we learn something that will help us from prevention standpoint? And then the other piece is, of course, that how can people do what they do? Right now, I'm working with a team looking at an added, why does the offender not just kill the victim? Why does the offender have to do additional things to the victim, such as either rape her or torture her or cut her up or dismember or mutilate? Why is that necessary if the intent, and clearly the intent isn't just to kill, but why would they do that? And maybe the other part is most people in their life are going to be a juror in a case, and that might help them as they listen to information. At least I tell my students that. I figure they all are going to be jurors at some point, so listen to this case and see what you think. And I will tell them, I'll say, you're the jury now. What would you do in this case?
How do you think the field has evolved since you first started studying, the trauma and rape and victims like this?
Well, the field has really evolved in a couple of directions. I was just doing a case this morning on an offender out of Georgia who was a serial killer. They called him the stocking killer, S-T-O-C-K-I-N-G, silk stockings. He would kill his victims and wrap them around his neck that way, their neck. And one of the things is there was plenty of forensic evidence, but they didn't have the equipment at that time to do the DNA. Nowadays, they would get that case solved in probably on the first or second victim because they'd have the DNA, and they would have prevented seven other crimes to women, elderly women down in that area. So DNA has been a major, major technology advance, not only for identifying a suspect, but for exonerating them. It's as useful to say who isn't a subject. So that's one thing, and that's in the forensic field has really advanced, and a lot of good research is going on. They can now take fingerprints off of all kinds of samples, and I could go on and on, but there are a lot of advances there. So that's in terms of the science piece of it. But the advances have been made also in terms of victim interviews and offender interviews and trying to prepare cases. I think prosecutors and defense attorneys have learned a lot over the years. So we see very different kinds of, very sophisticated kinds of presentations coming on now. So I guess it's, and then from a counseling standpoint, we have really improved how to help victims if they develop PTSD to advance or correct that. So I think all fronts we've made advances, say, in the last 10, 20 years.
What about the silent victims, the ones that are scared to report and stuff? Is there anything that's helped that come along?
Well, that's a whole different matter of why whether to report or not. And that's been a very serious problem for those of us who work with victims, for them to be able to come forward. And it's for a variety of reasons. It isn't for one or two reasons, but there can be a variety of reasons. Many times they're very embarrassed. They don't want to bring attention to themselves. But more importantly, it's one thing to have a victimization and not tell anybody, because then you don't have to deal with the reaction. When you tell somebody, whether it's a therapist or a counselor or take it to court, then you have to deal with the social reaction. And the social reaction can be as distressing and traumatizing. I know that we have a problem in the academic field or in situations where both the victim and the offender know each other. And they are resistant. The military, too, is also another place where this happens, because they then have to live in the situation where that the offender and victim may still be. Whether that's if you're in academia, it can be classes in the military, it can be under a command or, whatever. So it's very complicated when the offender is known. When the offender isn't known, it's easier for someone to come forward. But we've tried to help victims, and we often, or not we, but the attorneys will do a Jane Doe case. So her name is never used, or his name is never used. It will be John or Joe Jane Doe. And that's one way to protect the victim from public recognition.
Yeah, there's been a big rise in military sexual assaults, I've noticed through the media a lot. Why do you think that's happening?
A couple of reasons. Also, in the not just the military, but athletics and sports. And sometimes I think it's because of the kind of the culture. The culture is all male very often, or used to be all male. So they have a very kind of different set of rules and what constitutes what. Then the other piece is that the victim, because they are a well-known person, and it's going to be somebody that knows them, it's not going to be a stranger. And it can be in the military because somebody is a rank above them. And so bringing any kind of a charge against a higher rank is going to have its problems. And given the culture, I know I've worked some cases, it's been unbelievable what the higher ranks will say. It's like, you're making too much of this, or you're a soldier, you can't be, what are you complaining about? Those kinds of very demeaning statements are made to the person making a report. And that's not just the female, it can be a male in the military. But females have not been in the system that much, so I think that that's beginning to change. But on deployments, it can be a real serious problem. I could give you all kinds of really chilling stories that I've heard that I have no reason not to believe, and many times I fully understand why a victim doesn't come forward with it. That's not helpful, of course, for getting the offender. And so what the military has done now, I think, is a good thing, is that you could make a anonymous third-party report so that you don't have to identify yourself, but you can, at least the person can be identified.
And I would imagine it could really be hard on a victim, especially if they're going against someone in the public, because we saw that with the swearing in of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, remember, with the...
And
do people really understand it? Like, when we see that, and when that was going on, there was a lot of talk, like, you know, that the woman couldn't remember enough and different details and stuff, so it couldn't have happened. But that's not true, is it?
Well, what you're describing is kind of a, it's what we call a delayed disclosure that can take, and it depends on how delayed it is. Obviously, if it's weeks or months, it's not much. But if you've got years built up, as you say, memory can be faulty for pieces. Memory can be faulty suffering a trauma. So we have a number of factors that play against that whole bringing up and making a complaint. But you're right, it created a lot of emotion as well as discussion, sure. And then that what followed, I think that had, the Me Too movement had been before that, right? And then
yeah.
The Kavanaugh, yeah. So the kind of culture was already stirred up because of women, I think they were all women coming forward on...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Prominent persons in the entertainment field.
Yeah.
And then that case. So you always want to look at the context and that a case will come up within.
That's got to still be a big problem of believing the victim or believing the person that's claiming the assault.
It's always been a problem. Always been there. As long as I've been in the field, and I've been in quite a while, it's always been a problem. I can remember, more in the beginning, if somebody would call me on a case, they would say, do you believe her? Do you believe this happened? It was very important. And I can understand that, of course, if they're an attorney, they didn't want to, they were not that, it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of education out on that yet. And so I could understand it, but I still get it. That because nobody wants to put a lot of energy into a case and then find out it didn't happen or that the victim wouldn't come forward or, you know, something like that. So you're right. It's been an issue and it still is an issue.
Yeah, yeah. There's something in society, because even people having fake hate crimes and setting up things and
yep.
going to great lengths to
yep.
try to make themselves look like a victim.
Yeah, very, very true. Yeah.
What was your initial reactions to the Mindhunter series when it came out?
Well, I was curious. I was interested, of course. And John Douglas had told me it was coming. In fact, I thought it was rather delayed, that it was supposed to have come out earlier. I don't know. But anyway, it finally came out. And as I said, I was more, well, a couple of reactions. First, they didn't have me in the right profession. I am a nurse, a psychiatric nurse, and they had me as a psychologist. And it's, you know, obviously I can't correct that, but I hope that I've said it enough that if they ever identify me again, they'll identify me as a nurse. I was interested in how accurate were they for the cases, because we had worked so hard on the data and I knew these cases inside and out. And I have to say they were pretty accurate. They got the key factors in. They, of course, had to play Hollywood and dress them up, you know, in some different type of context. But as to the actual facts of the case, I thought they were pretty accurate.
So you feel pretty good about it?
Well, I think it taught things. I thought it added a dimension. Our work had been used and is still used in Criminal Minds. It didn't get the play that Mindhunter did, but in Criminal Minds, if you remember back to some of the early shows, they would always start off with the victimology. They'd always do the profile. You'd see one of the actors standing up and saying, "Look for this," and da da da, and go on down. So I thought that had gone well, but then of course as the years went on, they had to kind of up the quality of it, or however you want to call it. So it's I don't know where it's at now, but at least in Mindhunter, I knew that they were basing it on actual cases, and that I thought was very important and good.
So did you ever get a chance to actually participate in one of the serial killer interviews as is portrayed in the show?
Not from Mindhunter. I did, of course, knew all the data, and we talked about all of the cases, et cetera, in writing up the book. We did a book, you know, out of that, as Holden says, a book? Yes, it was a book. And it wasn't Mindhunter. It was another book. But at any rate, we did that. And
was that sexual homicide patterns and motives?
That's it, yeah. That's the academic part of the book. And then, of course, John wrote the Mindhunters. Now, the Mindhunters, the agents were all called Mindhunters at the time, back in the 80s. So that's the title he took for his book, yeah.
So, now, a lot of the different things you came across in the show, it almost seemed like you were just kind of stumbling your way onto different phenomena. Is that sort of how it really happened, or what did happen?
Well, what did happen? Well, this was an academic exercise, so you take data, you crunch it down, and then you look at your findings, and then you have to make the interpretation. So. That's essentially what we did. We were always, my goal, and I hope I reached it, was to always look at the patterns and the motives. I was looking for pattern. That's what I had done in the rape study on rape trauma syndrome, was looking at the pattern. And I think that, and then we decided, and we wrote a number of papers from the homicide data, but then how do we put it into a book? And we put it in pretty much those chapters. Or how do these killers grow up? What was unique or not unique? And then what made the difference? And I think that's what our major contribution was how they thought from an early age about killing. Because most kids don't think and fantasize about killing, but these 36 men did. And then we had to explain, why did they keep killing? Once it's one thing to kill once, but why keep doing it, and that's where we came up with what we called the motivational model of how that's a circular in the heads of these guys to make them be very compulsive to keep killing.
Were you able to always maintain a clinical approach to this? Did it ever personally bother you, the gruesome details that you were dealing with day to day?
Well, all murder bothers me. So yes, I'd have to say that it's a terrible behavior that occurs to a person. But I was as interested in getting the information out to see if we could prevent it, if we could get to these people earlier and get mental health to understand it, or law enforcement of how to approach these situations, and often to look and see if you can see the pattern and then figure out the suspect through the profiling. So I was, and I think our whole team was caught up in that, of having the larger goal to get this done. But at an individual level, these were terrible cases of what happened to women and children predominantly, and not so many men. Men get murdered, but not sexually murdered.
So the character that is kind of who you're supposed to be in the Mindhunters, I'm wondering, she was fairly strong and independent in that show. Were you one of the only few females in the FBI and in that department at the time?
Pretty much. Now, the females they had were the support staff. So, you know, you had females, but they were at a level, not at an agent level. They were the secretaries, administrative assistants, that type. As far as the agent went, I remember three that came in the time I was there, but it was unusual for a female to come in, mainly because in the FBI you had to serve in another, you had to kind of go through the ropes and serve in a different capacity, and then to get to the academy you had to have a lot of experience. So there were none in the program at the time I was there, but as I said, more came in, and now I think it's quite diverse.
Wow. It's amazing. Now, what do you think of the series overall?
The Mindhunter series, a series overall?
Yeah.
People
get?
I hope people get, first of all, from the first series, the one that was last year, the first series, I think what they showed were the ways of interviewing and some of the reactions that the offenders had. And I think that's good, of that it's not very easy for the agents to go in and just sit down and talk to these men. And they certainly learned very quickly, if you read Wrestler's book, that they always would send two in, that to send one person in, that put Wrestler in a really tight situation. And so they always send two in, which makes sense. So that was, I think that's what was taught, the way they, and the ones they did were the main ones we had. That would have been Monte Risso, who was a rape murderer, and then I always combine him or compare him with Ed Kemper, who was a lust murderer, who would have killed and then done things to the body. And then you had Brutus, the shoe fetish. I mean, they really did mix and match there in that whole first episode. In the second episode, they have gone to different types of offenders. I think Manson and I forget all of them. But so they're doing a different way, which I think is good, to mix them up a bit. And I have no idea what they're going to do for a third episode. There were only 36, but John Douglas has many more cases that he had done while he was in the Bureau, more than the 36 that we studied. So I think they have drawn from that population.
Now,
I've done my own. You asked about mine. I've done my own cases since all of that, because I certainly learned a lot in interviewing and putting a case together.
You had some sort of involvement in the satanic panic abuse cases, didn't you?
Not in the satanic cult stuff. I did a couple of preschool, pre-kindergarten cases, like daycare cases.
Right.
And I did them at three separate federal agencies because I was asked to come in and help. They seem to have some satanic features to it, but in one of the cases, it was just young people who were the caretakers or the workers there who were scaring the kids and using that. So it wasn't a real, I never worked a whatever would be considered a real cult case, no.
Wow. And now false sexual abuse claims. Have you dealt with a lot of that?
False sexual abuse claims I've done. I did the Duke LaCrosse case. That was a big major one. That's probably the most major one. I certainly have done some others where there has been an allegation of sexual abuse and not necessarily followed through. Did we get the evidence for it? So I'd have to say the Duke LaCrosse case was the main one I did.
Wow. So what do you do nowadays? Are you still writing books, or are you doing speeches, or what kind of work are you doing now?
All of the above. I teach, of course, I teach, I have five courses I teach at Boston College, and they're in the forensic field. One's victimology, where each week we do a different type of victim. Then in the spring, I do the offender. Each week we do the crime case from the offender standpoint. And then I do forensic science, which is putting the case together, and I do a lab. So I teach, and I still do cases, and I do speaking. Pretty much all that I've always done.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Now, do you have a website?
No.
No, staying away from the...
No. I don't even have an iPhone.
Oh, you're smart.
I stay away from that. I don't need anything extra to take my concentration away.
Yeah, just. Do you have any influences that have really affected your life?
Influences. My professional work, working with crime victims, certainly has. The other thing I do that I like to, I'm actually trying to get a replication study to do, is I've had a great interest in veterans and veterans coming back into academe and trying to be absorbed into the academic setting. So I have my student athletes, I pair them with a veteran, and they have a workout twice a week, and then we bring them over for a little class, use any type of faculty. I get my faculty to come in and talk, and then that has worked really well, and it's something that I feel nursing can do for the from an academic standpoint within to encourage more coming back. And BC has its own now advisory board for veterans and is making a real concerted effort to make veterans feel comfortable coming back into finishing their degree.
Wow. Now your last book was in 2013, Crime Classifications Manual.
That's true.
Now, what is it that you wrote that book for? Like, what were you wanting to get across to people?
Well, that was trying to, if you will, kind of mimic what the DSM is to mental health, a diagnostic and statistical manual, where at the time a crime was, a murder was a murder, and rape was a rape, and they didn't have any way of classifying it. So you really can't do treatment or intervention or understand cases if you just have a kind of a conglomeration of a type. So we tried to separate out and make categories. So that's what that was about. That was the first one. Now it's up to the third edition, and it's just on kind of an encyclopedia of types of crimes.
I read it at the second edition, and I'm a big crime nerd, so I really dug it.
Good.
It's not for everybody, obviously, because
no.
it's dense.
Yes. Yeah, I thought, yeah, it's an academic book. You're absolutely correct, yeah.
Or
we make sense books.
Yeah. Or the sexual homicides and sexual, crimes, are they evolving or changing through time?
Oh, I think they are. In fact, we have a conference coming up called The Evolution of Evil, and the speakers we have out of Columbia University, Michael Stone, who's a psychiatrist, and Gary Brucato, who is a psychologist, have spent a lot of time. Oh, good. Okay, so you know what they've done. But there's your, and they make the point that they do think that there have been changes, and I would agree in our culture that we are seeing different kinds of cases. Just one little tiny group that I had worked with, the National Center Missing and Exploited Children, when we were looking at just infant abductions, little babies being stolen from hospitals. And then pretty soon we began to see that there was what they call fetal abduction, where women were going in and literally cutting into the uterus of a pregnant woman to steal a baby. That's new, and that's almost doubled in the last 5 or 10 years. So what's going on, you know, that kind of phenomenon? And then the whole dismemberment, if you've talked with Stone and Bacata, they looked at the whole dismemberment issue. You almost can see it once a week. Some place in the United States is reporting a case.
So that'll be on Saturday, October 5th at Boston College.
Yeah. Oh, at BC,
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Very interesting. Very, very, quite the subject. How do you stay happy? How do you stay happy?
How do you stay happy?
Wow. You know, are you surprised at how big it's gotten? You know, on TV, it's on movies, there's.
Oh, I know.
Networks.
What is the big draw? It is something that people get of all ages, pretty much all ages, people get drawn to it,
Interestingly, for me, I'm a host of a true crime podcast, and I would say 90% or better of my listeners are women.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So. Huh. Yeah, so I'm often thinking, what is that? And a lot of it is probably what you've mentioned. Most of the victims are women or children.
Women. Sure. The child victims. You talk about tough cases. They're tough. They're very tough.
Oh, it's got to be.
Everybody is affected by them.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly been interesting, and we really appreciate you coming on and talking about this happy Christmas subject.
Yeah, I know.
dear.
And we wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you.
And again, our guest has been Ann Burgess, and we'll have your books and everything posted up on our site so people can do one click and pick up a book
and look for the next one.
Look for the next one.
It's there you go. Okay, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fantastic. Yep.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.